Welcome to the Careering into Motherhood podcast with me, Jane Johnson. My guest today is Sarah Jackson, OBE. Sarah is a work-life balance and flexible working expert. Since becoming a parent, her working life has involved campaigning and practical action to make paid work more inclusive of parents and carers. She was the CEO of Working Families, a role which at times she job shared and job split. She sometimes worked reduced hours, all in order to retain time for her family. Her experience at Working Families included the annual Employer Best Practice Awards, commissioning and editing research into flexible working, and lobbying government on behalf of working parents. She's an expert in workplace discrimination and in family-friendly, flexible working best practice and policy development. She's also visiting professor at Cranfield University, chair of PEPA, Parents and Carers in Performing Arts, deputy chair of the social justice charity Commonweal Housing, and a trustee of ROSA, the UK Fund for Women and Girls. And I am delighted to be able to add to that list of her responsibilities and say that effective from this month, Sarah is a member of the Careering into Motherhood Advisory Board. I thought you might like to hear more about her life and her campaign work. So thank you very much for agreeing to do this. I'm very interested to talk to you because although we loosely are starting to get to know one another, obviously in your role on the advisory board, I would like to just start by, if you would, talk a little bit about your career journey, you personally, how you got to the point of being such a supportive or vociferous campaigner for the rights of working parents.
Well, I was a campaigner. The jobs I had for money were saving various things. They were all campaigny sort of jobs. And then in 91, my daughter was born. A year later, I went back to work part-time and fairly quickly worked out that if I was to be ambitious, even in the right-on bit of the voluntary sector that I worked in, it didn't help to be a working mother.
But you went back part-time, so on the one hand, you could say, well, you were able to negotiate that or find a part-time role, but was it that you felt it wasn't at the level or on the same trajectory as it you had been?
It wasn't going anywhere. It was very obvious within that organisation where I stayed for a couple of years that the people who were valued were the ones who were staying after 5 o'clock. And I knew that, you know, I'd been in that world. I remember having a colleague and we used to talk admiringly about him, that he would sleep wrapped in the flag of El Salvador at the office. You know, kind of, he never went home and that was a mark of absolute commitment. But you reassess all of that when you become a parent. And anyway, basically I was just thinking to myself, and nothing was advertised less than full time back in 1993-94, except for one job that said chief executive wanted 30 hours a week, Working Mothers Association, which sounded to me like a very quaint Edwardian outfit, but actually turned out to have been set up about 10 years before. Eventually I got that and I stayed for 24 years.
And so did the Working Mothers Association, they had to offer something on, you know, compressed hours, that sort of thing. And, you know, were they true to their word? So you are living proof that you can be a CEO or lead an organisation, compressed in inverted commas, hours?
I would say yes and no. I think there's an absolute trade-off to be made. Working Mothers Association, which even before the ink was dry in my contract, it had become Parents at Work. And then about 10 years later, we turned it into Working Families. So I worked variously on a sort of job split with the founder, Lucy Daniels, who was still there when I started. We then had a job shared for a bit and I worked on reduced hours. Almost everybody, certainly in those early days, was on some form of flexible or reduced hours pattern. And remember as well, you know, this is mid-90s, so we didn't talk really about flexible working. Was such a new concept that I found it hard to get my lips around it. You know, it was people worked part-time or full-time. That was kind of what it was. And we all worked in the office, obviously, because there wasn't the tech that we have today. But it was an enormously refreshing culture. I remember the very first board meeting I went to, and all the trustees, all these eminent, wonderful women, we went around the table and they each introduced themselves in terms of their family responsibilities first and their professional responsibilities second. So it was clearly somewhere completely different.
But did you take that role because you felt aggrieved by your own experience and that you wanted to do something? Or did you take that, for want of a better phrase, because there wasn't anything else?
Both, mostly because there wasn't anything else. The issues that the Working Mothers Association were focused on, which was primarily around childcare, I knew nothing about. You know, I had a childminder, and you know, wonderful, and she was with us for, well, till my youngest was 12, and we're still friends. So that was, you know, that was my bedrock of my ability to be a working parent, rested on the fact that I got childcare sorted out right from the start. And I was tremendously fortunate in that. But yes, I wanted the job because I was feeling grumpy. I didn't want to stay where I was. And I hadn't seen anything else that would allow me to be senior and less than full time, because I knew that I didn't want to work full time. Eve's dad was working in the city. He was an oil and gas man. So he was working long hours and or he was away. So, you know, it was an obvious choice. It is the obvious choice that many couples make, that she decides to make career compromises in some way or other, because that's just the financial sense of it, isn't it? But one of the first things, well, within 5 years, I'd done a piece of research, less than 5 years, did a piece of research looking at work-life balance in the voluntary sector. And that made it, I teamed up with a very fabulous woman called Dorothy Dalton, who's still very much in the world of voluntary sector best practice and governance. And Dorothy and I did this thing where we did a survey of charity chief executives to find out about their work-life balance. And it was absolutely clear that charity chief executives worked longer hours than they were contracted for, you know, by about, I don't know, people were kind of averaging about 50-hour weeks and they were all being paid for 35 to 37. And that was why, as I moved through the career at Working Families, there were various points at which the board said, why don't we pay you full time, because you're working pretty much full time. I was doing, I think, 30 to 35 hours a week and being paid for between 25 and 28 variously. And I never wanted to go full time because I knew that as soon as I had the full time money, I'd feel morally obligated to work full time hours, and that would be 50. And I just wasn't up for that. And so that, I guess, was a fairly early lesson in the dysfunctionality of senior roles in the UK. The number that's on your contract is not the number that you're expected to work.
Yeah, and I suspect that, you know, that's from my experience, I haven't worked in the charity sector. That's not specific to the charity sector. I think that's across the board. But therefore, and I don't mean to immediately jump on the gender card, but it does seem that that is a way, therefore, that women will continuously be, that gender pay gap will be heightened, and the domestic load and all those other things that go with motherhood, if we're taking these roles where we all assume that we have to give more than we're paid. And if you are, let's take a traditional, in inverted commas, family where you have one partner who is the breadwinner and one partner who earns less, that partner who is the breadwinner will always have more flex and more scope to be able to give more, because they're not also taking on all of the other responsibilities that you mentioned.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is absolutely the case. And you're judged by the extra that you give. It's toxic and damaging. And it's only been around for 40 years. Okay, it was something happened in the 80s. And you can say it was Thatcherism. You can say it was the Big Bang in the city. There was a point in the 80s when the relationship that we have with work changed fundamentally. So, you know, I think about my dad, who was a civil servant, and he left the house at 8:30 and he was back at 5:30.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't working. He worked weekends. He was in the Forestry Commission. So weekends, if he was on fire duty, yes. If some forest went up in Aberdeenshire, he had to be there. But his day was completely defined and his work didn't spill over. And yet you look at my generation, who left university in the early 80s, those of us who went into professional roles went into worlds that had ceased to be respectful of our time outside work and were looking for a contract which said you will give your whole self, whether you are in the city or in the media or in the voluntary sector or the NHS, whatever it is you're doing, we no longer value time. We're now just saying, get on and do the job. And the jobs, senior jobs, have become too big for one person to do. They're not human-sized.
Yeah. Social media or globalization, or maybe, you know, a combination of lots of other things, have feel to me as though they have accentuated this problem, this always on. It's no longer enough to just be working until 8 o'clock at night. It's, are you responding to emails at weekends, and are you responding to emails first thing in the morning? I mean, I have one of my questions down here is, how have things improved in the workforce for women over the last 40 years? But this is not just a women in the workforce debate or issue. This is everyone in the workforce.
You see, I think there has been a huge improvement in terms of flexible working.
Mm.
Because those horrendous workloads are not there throughout, at every level of every organisation. There are a lot of people who work their hours and who now have additional rights to flexibility that they didn't 40 years ago. But then at the top and the bottom of the working pile, if you like, people who are doing senior roles or professional services roles, or many people in the health service, are being, you know, they have, it's got worse. They've got all the flexibility you like to manage the impossible. And then low paid people, many of them, don't have the autonomy over their hours that they used to have. So, you know, if you were in a, I don't know, a routine occupation in the 1970s, you knew what time you would get to work and you knew what time you would leave. Whereas now, if you're in a routine occupation, many, many people are just at the whim of some computer algorithm. And that's enormously stressful. Bad for people's mental health, never mind their family incomes.
Yes, absolutely. I was having a conversation with a woman just yesterday about this concept of flexible working and mental health, and specifically for mothers. And she said she thinks this is the next pandemic of our society, the mental health issue, because she says, yes, while I now, since COVID pandemic, while I have more flexibility, she was in an office role in an agency in the city, where previously they had to be in the office 5 days a week. Now there's more fluidity. But she said, I literally, you know, I get up in the morning, I do what I can to clear the emails. Then I drop my children to school. Then I come home. Then I'm putting on the washing. Then I'm doing some work. Then I'm going to pick them up. Then I'm, because I have to get through the work, I'm going back online till 8 o'clock, leaving the children some tea and, you know, putting them in front of the TV, helping them a bit through the walls with their homework and so on and so forth. But she just said, she sat down in front of me and she just said, I feel absolutely frazzled. This has not stopped. And I suppose, Sarah, with all your, well, just with all of your experience, what are your thoughts on what the future holds? We've been campaigning and pushing so far and so hard for flexible working, but is it actually benefiting? Is it the nirvana that we all hoped for?
Poor old flexible working has been held up as, there's just far too much expectation laid on flexible working. It's a really, really useful tool, and I'm so glad we have it. We didn't have it 40 years ago, we do now. It allows us to have much greater control and autonomy over when, where, and how long we work for. And there's absolutely no doubt that the experience over the last couple of years has normalised flexible working in many workplaces, in a way that it just wasn't there before. However, the problems that we're trying to deal with are not about flexible working at all. They're about work design and workloads. They're about expectations. They're about gendered expectations. They're about the fact that, you know, we women are more than 50% of the population, therefore more than 50% of the talent. And women are all different. Some women want to fling themselves wholeheartedly into a career. Other women want to be wholehearted, full-on mums. I think the vast majority of women probably want a mixture of them both. And actually, the more you speak to fathers nowadays, you understand most men actually want that. They want a mixture as well. But the way we think about work and the way we think about care is pushing us into opposite camps, if you like. And all the flexible working in the world is not going to solve the assumptions that either you make or your boss makes about who should be in the office or who should be on the shop floor and who shouldn't be, and who should be holding the baby's hand and who shouldn't be.
Yes. And so from your personal perspective, what would you like to see in the future? And I mean, again, all the campaigning and the work you have done and still do, do you have a vision of what the future should and could look like? Or is it more iterative than that?
It's always going to be iterative because progress happens in, you know, stops and starts and hops and jumps. But I can see three things that really have to change if we are going to make the most of all the talents that men and women have in the UK and also make them offer the most to our children around family life. So the first, I guess, is the tinkering around the edges. It's let's just finish the flexible working job. Let's get to a point where every job is assessed for its flexibility and is advertised with whatever flex is available. You know, that just let's tidy that up, put it out of the way. That's great. That's flex working done. The next thing we've got to do is match up parental leave. Because as long as you've got a situation where she gets 52 weeks offered and he gets two and anything else is just her choice to transfer, there's never going to be an equality of emotional, just emotional equality between the two parents. And also managers and organisations will continue to make quite reasonable assumptions about who's going to take time off and who isn't. And until we have domestic equality, we can't possibly have workplace equality. And that we've proved, I think, conclusively in the last 40 years. And the third thing is, for Pete's sake, it's childcare. Because as long as you've got a gap between the end of the statutory leave period and the beginning of school, and that's currently sitting at 2 years for most families, every couple has got to make decisions about who works and who doesn't during that period. And I'm absolutely not arguing that every baby should go into full-time nursery care from, you know, 6 months and stay there till they start toddling through the gates of the primary school. I mean, what I'd really like to see is a childcare and leave and flexible working package that means that the majority of couples will choose for both of them to work less than full-time. So they won't need full-time childcare. So you have part-time childcare, you've got two part-time working couples. That presupposes that we have had to rethink the design of work so that men and women are not penalised in terms of their career progression because they are taking several years working less than full-on full-time. So that's my vision.
Yes, it doesn't sound that hard when you talk about it either.
It shouldn't be that hard, but we've got such, I suppose, still a deep-rooted sense that it's your choice to have a child. Child care, child bearing, child rearing is a private decision and a private issue. Whereas actually society falls apart if there are no more babies.
I see. Yeah, of course. But I also wonder how much of this, and this is where, as we've talked about, careering into motherhood sees a chink of light on the horizon, that at the moment, large corporates and probably government and the whole doesn't see a burning platform. It's really hard. While we all know there are huge economic benefits to getting this right and to sorting out the current mess that we have, there doesn't feel like there is a burning platform. But as you said earlier, you know, we are 51% at least of the population and therefore of the talent, and we have this opportunity to go and create a work design that does work for us. And you know, I worry that waiting for this to happen, or not waiting, but campaigning and lobbying for this to happen falls on certain ears. And we see things like the Flexible Working Task Force, and there was the current trial of 4-day week with 300,000 people or whatever it is. You know, they're all great and they grab the headlines, but it doesn't feel to me, and I've only been in this space for about 6 years, as though we are moving but with anything but glacial pace. And I don't mean to be all negative about it. I'm actually quite optimistic, but I guess, how do we harness the 51% of us that do want change? And it's more than 51% because we do have allies, we do have supporters who are not female.
Is there a burning platform? There is. I mean, I can see the burning platform very clearly, but I can also see that the burning platform almost has to happen organization by organization. But if you think about the corporates, the big corporates, I think that the mental and physical well-being challenge really is a burning platform for them. Because any organization, if we're thinking about the corporate sector or NHS or teaching, you know, some of the big public service areas as well, the stress caused by badly designed work that has to be delivered over longer hours than is physically and mentally good for you, that is really building up into a national health crisis. The other bit of the burning platform is just the wasted talent. You know, right now in the UK, we are screaming out, we've got so many vacancies, and people are saying there is now one person chasing each vacancy, or one vacancy chasing each person. I mean, it seems to me that this is now a moment for, well, if we had a government that had any form of vision or imagination, rather than shelving the employment bill, which they have, and forgetting about flexible working, they would be seriously thinking about what can we do to finish off the flexible working agenda. What can we do about childcare? What can we do about parental leave? How can we actually make it much easier for every parent in the UK who wants to work to be able to work? And I don't know how to, in the end, get, I suppose, you know, you say it's glacial change. It can feel glacial when you're in it. But I think when you start looking back, if you think about the way the 30% Club have changed the landscape in terms of gender balance on boards, now that's taken 10, 15 years or so. And I wonder whether there should be a similar corporate-focused, corporate-led wellbeing at work campaign. I think we're getting to the point where it becomes very, very hard. And conversations I have with senior people in the corporate world about the size of jobs and the demands that have been made on senior people are unsatisfactory, I think, because there's a mindset that says the client wants to have this one named person. You've been there. And I don't know how to get around that. And it's balanced by people are hugely well rewarded in some of the jobs that are damaging them and damaging their families. So people, I think, feel quite, it's a bit like me saying I wouldn't take a full-time salary for what I could see would not be a full-time role. My contract would have been full-time, but if I wasn't willing to work 50 hours, I wasn't prepared to take full-time salary. So I can quite understand if you're paid silly amounts of money by Megacorp Inc., then you know that you've actually sold yourself 7 a.m. to midnight, 7 days a week, and you kind of feel it's fair. But I think we need a bigger conversation. I think back to a few years ago, she's called the High Mistress of St. Paul's Girls' School. It was somebody like that who talked about the sort of the emotional damage she saw being done to some of her pupils because the parents had so much money. So the young people didn't want for anything material. What they lacked was time with their parents and focus. So parents were so busy running around having their dual careers and earning every material good that their children could possibly want and every material opportunity in terms of fantastic education and, you know, certainly in those days, a flight path through Oxbridge or Yale or whoever, and then into the city or to become prime minister, whatever it was. But she was saying, actually, these are young people who are damaged because the time element of family life has been lost.
Yes, and yet we're covering lots of big issues here, but it's almost, I think it's a bit like social media. Once you've gone there, you can't come back. So that thing of the materialism, and as you touched on at the start, you know, it changed very significantly and poignantly in the 80s. And I remember exactly as you talked about earlier, my father used to, in the 70s, he had a job in a factory, but as a manager there, and he would leave in the mornings, but he was back by 5:30, 6 o'clock. But then things changed, and with redundancies and all that kind of thing, and wanting to put your children through wherever. And then your point now about these parents, or not these parents, I'm probably guilty of it to a degree myself, you know, parents now brought up on a diet of you must provide, you must give everything you possibly can to your children. So, yeah, almost materially, but time is the one thing that we all really struggle to. Well, I say all that my friends and I know we struggle to create quality time with our children.
I also remember Penny Leach, the childcare expert, years and years and years ago, tackling quality time. And she said, it's not about quality time, it's just about time. She said, basically, make your business your children's business. She was speaking at a Parents at Work conference, and she was essentially saying, don't stress about doing something memorable with your seven-year-old. Just get them to help with the washing up.
Mm. You know? That is just those interactions and being within the family.
Yeah. And that was, for me, that was in the early days of my working parenthood. I found that an enormously comforting and terribly sensible thing to say, because I just thought, yeah, actually, and that's really what we did. We just made sure that family life was, whatever was going on, was all happening together, as far as, I don't know, you know, homework on the kitchen table while I cooked, that sort of thing.
Yes. There's so much that we could cover. I'm slightly conscious of time because our listeners are busy working mums. But I would like to, I guess, close by asking you what you see in the future. You mentioned yourself, you have a daughter. Do you feel optimistic? Do you think that we will strike a balance, and will people be happier 40 years from now? Will parents, working parents, be happier 40 years from now?
Now, that's a very interesting question. I'm sure they will be as happy, if not happier. I don't know. I think every generation of parents has their own struggles to deal with. And ultimately, your happiness comes down to the quality of your relationships and having enough. So I hope for my daughter and my son, I hope that if and when they have children, they're able to find, it's the balance. I wish for them a healthy balance of time, money and responsibilities, if you like, so that they can feel that they have the space in their family life to give to their partners and to their children. And I think that's the most valuable thing you can give to your children, really, is time and focus, I suppose, and enough money, so that they're not hungry and they're not judging themselves against their peers, but they feel sort of safe. And so I suppose ultimately it's, I hope that when they're both in the workforce now, but they don't have kids, I hope that the work that they all end up doing with their partners makes space for them to have the kind of family life that they want.
I really feel this almost warrior-like sense of anger, excitement, optimism and pure frustration about what we go through as working parents, and specifically working mothers, after that conversation. I feel more driven than ever to continue trying to build and do what we're trying to do at Careering Into Motherhood. Sarah is so measured and calm, yet also so incredibly driven to see change. As someone who has effectively dedicated her whole working life to enhancing the lives of other parents. You can find out more about Sarah on our website and her own, www.sarahjackson.org. And if you're a member of Careering Into Motherhood, then you'll be seeing and hearing a lot more from Sarah over the coming year. Sarah also does speaking engagements and things, so do get in touch with her if you'd like her to come and talk to your organisation. Thank you. We'll be back next time.